Your Grace,
Your Lordship,
Your Grace, Archbishop Emeritus, Your Eminences, ladies and gentlemen.
A conversion can be a symbol of a beginning. Definitely, it was no coincidence that the Blessed Pope John XXIII, less than 3 months after his election as a pope in October 1958, chose the feast of the conversion of St. Paul in January 1959 to announce his intention to convene an ecumenical council, un concilium, an expression which took the world by surprise. However, the widespread reaction to this announcement from religious and secular leaders, both inside and outside the Catholic Church, was largely positive. Pope John made it clear that it was a time to open the windows of the Catholic Church to let in some fresh air, and he might have been a bit euphemistic about it. This year, we are commemorating the 50th anniversary of the opening of this great council on the 11th of October, 1962. Unfortunately, so far, there have been only muted commemorations of this council. The Stern wants you to share with us the joy expressed by Pope John Paul, John XXIII, when he declared the opening of Vatican II by the words, Gaudet Mater Ecclesia. The council sessions started with a shock, which was to mark not only the running of the council, but also the future of the church. It started with a rupture with the centuries immediately preceding it, and by calling to a return to a tradition, to the tradition with capital T. It was not a rupture of doctrine. According to Professor Enrico Morini of Bologna, Vatican II set itself in the perspective of absolute continuity with the tradition of the first millennium. Since the first millennium is the history of the Church, of that Church of seven councils, which was still undivided. The Council encouraged the renewal of the Church and did not intend to introduce anything new, as progressives and conservatives respectively desire and fear. But it wanted to return back to what had been lost. Vatican II ought to have brought a rupture in the way the Church, our Church, was administered or run, by a centralized body modeled on medieval ways of governance. The structure was also made visible in the first session of the Council on Saturday, October 13, 1962. The session's agenda included the election of members of the 10 conciliar commissions. It had expected that the members of the preparatory commissions, where the Curia was heavily represented, would be confirmed as a majority on the conciliar commissions. Cardinal Aquila Llanar took the floor and addressed the council, saying that the bishops could not intelligently vote for strangers. He asked for a postponement of the vote to give all bishops the chance to draw up their own list. This motion was seconded by Cardinal Frings, and the vote was postponed. Hence, the very first meeting of the council was postponed just 15 minutes after the start. The council father made it clear that they weren't ready to sit within the boundaries of what Max Weber called the iron cage of bureaucracy. The result was that several Catholic theologians, who, to say the least, were looked at with great suspicion by what was then the Holy Office, were invited to be expert theologians of Vatican II. And the Papa Buono made it a point that he wanted observers from other Christian churches and denominations outside the Catholic Church. Even on the 8th of December, 1966, while commemorating the first anniversary of the closing Chesin of Vatican II, Pope Paul VI told us that this council shines among the great events of Christianity. At this early stage, Paul VI warned the Church of two possible errors which should be avoided. The first error which he names was that of supposing that Vatican II represents a break with the doctrinal and disciplinary tradition which preceded it, a subjective emancipation and almost pseudo-liberation from what till then the Church has authoritatively taught and professed. And since there is nothing more original than the original, I'm going to quote him in Italian. Il concilio tanto vale quanto continua la vita della Chiesa. Esso non la interrompe, non la deforma, non la inventa, ma la conferma, la sviluppa, la perfeziona, la aggiorna. The idea of aggiornamento logically implies that there certainly were things and issues which, at least if not outdated, were not up to date. What was needed was not some patching up here and there. Otherwise, the Pope wouldn't have called an ecumenical council to do this. Other instruments would have sufficed to achieve it. Cardinal Cotier, the Dominican theologian who was the theologian of the papal household, has written that to get to the roots, we need to grasp the inner countenance of the Church that the council sought to recognize and represent to the world in its effort to come back to date. On the same occasion, in defense of Vatican II, Paul VI pointed to a second error, which unfortunately nowadays is hardly heard of. An error which is opposed to the faithfulness which we owe to the Council. And again, I'm going to quote the Pope. L'altro errore sarebbe quello di disconoscere l'immensa ricchezza di insegnamenti e la provenienziale fecondità rinnovatrice che dal Concilio stesso ci viene. Volentieri dobbiamo attribuire ad esso virtù di principio piuttosto che di conclusione. Perché se è vero che esso storicamente e materialmente si pone come epilogo complementare e logico del Concilio Ecumenico Vaticano I, in realtà esso rappresenta altresì un atto nuovo e originale coscienza e di vita della Chiesa di Dio, atto che apre alla Chiesa stessa per il suo interno sviluppo, per i rapporti con i fratelli tuttora da noi disgiunti, per le relazioni con i seguaci di altre religioni, con il mondo moderno, qual è magnifico e complesso, formidabile e tormentato, offrire nuovi e meravigliosi sentieri. And again, ad un anno di distanza, noi cominciamo a meglio comprenderne l'enorme importanza. Esso si scrive fra gli grandi eventi del cristianesimo, anzi, della vita religiosa dell'umanità, per la sua coerenza storica, per la sua felice celebrazione, per la sua ricchezza dottrinare, per la sua fecondità pratica, per la sua profondità spirituale e per la sua apertura universale. Non dobbiamo chiudere gli occhi su fatto di tale natura e di tale rilievo. Non lo possiamo classificare fra le cose passate, quando per ogni verso ci segue, ci stimola, ci illumina, ci impegna. Once George Bernard Shaw said that England and America are two countries separated by one language. Allow me to borrow his idea and say that it's a misfortune that several Catholics are making the common language of Vatican II a source of division. As Cardinal Cotier, which I quoted, maintains, disputes of hermeneutical nature, important though they may be, risk becoming controversies among experts. Whereas it may be of interest to everyone, especially in the present moment, to rediscover what the source was of the inspiration that animated the Second Vatican Council. I am glad this evening to see this event as Cotier saw it, that is, as a common response which acknowledges that the event was motivated by the desire to renew the inner life of the Church and also to adapt its disciplines to new exigencies so as to repropose with renewed vigor the requirements of its mission to the modern world, alert in faith to the signs of the times. I'm glad tonight to have with us Professor Massimo Fagioli of the University of St. Thomas, Minnesota, to lecture us exactly on this problematic. Professor Fagioli studied religious history at the University of Torino, but then carried out scientific research at the Foundation for Religious Sciences, Giovanni XXIII, commonly known as the Scuola di Bologna, from 1996 to 2008. His recent publications include the following books: Il Vescovo e il Concilio, Modello Episcopale e Aggiornamento al Vaticano II, Breve Storia dei Movimenti Cattolici, Angelo Nucalli, Giovanni XXIII, Le Agende di Bulgaria. And his recent book published this year in English, Vatican II, The Battle for Meaning. Next September, we are expecting his next publication, Reforming the Church at Vatican II, The Deep Implications of Sacrosanctum Concilium. Professor Fagioli, over to you.
Good evening, everybody. It's a great honor to be here. I'm really thankful for this invitation. As you know, I come from St. Paul in Minnesota, and to make me feel home, I was taken today to a wonderful lunch on the bay of St. Paul, so I felt really home, and I discovered among friends in the audience some very interesting Minnesota connections that I couldn't really imagine. The title of my talk is Vatican II dangerous or in danger? I will divide my remarks in three sections. The first section is a short history of the debate on the Council. The second section will be a brief description of the main issues on the interpretation of the Council. And the third short session will be my interpretation of this debate, my take, and my views on what's going to happen to the Second Vatican Council. Pope John the 23rd announced Vatican II on January the 25th, 1959, and after a long period preparing the text to be discussed between 1962 and 1965, 2,500 bishops and hundreds of theologians from all over the world assembled for the first time, the representatives of a church that had begun to shape herself as a world church from a cultural and theological standpoint. A decisive element in the passage from a heavily European Catholicism toward a world Catholicism was the contribution of the revival movements in the first decades of the 20th century. The biblical movement, the liturgical renewal, the patristic revival, and ressourcement, a return to the earlier sources of an undivided church, and the ecumenical movement. But also the institutional mechanics of the Council contributed to the growth of this global awareness of the Catholic Church at Vatican II. Its geographical setting in Rome, the capital of world Catholicism, the quasi-parliamentarian mechanism in the aula of, on the floor of St. Peter, the relationship between a majority and a minority, the system of assemblies, commissions and subcommissions, the amendments on the proposed text, the lobbying outside the aula. Another factor was the long duration of the event, of the Council, 7 years from its announcement in January 1959 to its conclusion in December 1965, with four very intense sessions in the autumn seasons between 1962 and 65. All of these provided the press, the radio, and the new media of television with a not-to-be-missed event of change within an institution, the Catholic Church, which had always been held immutability as a strength. Vatican II gave the media and the world a new face for global Catholicism, but to a certain extent, it is undeniable that the media coverage of Vatican II also had an impact on developing in the bishops and theologians themselves, convened in Rome, a new sense of the global dimension of the Church in its trying to reunite Christians. A second phase in the reception of the Council was between 1965, after the end, and in the 1970s. On December the 8th, 1965, the end of the Council meant the return of bishops and theologians from Rome to their local churches. But it did not mean the conclusion of the debates or the end of the Roman Curia's attempt to control the final outcome of the Council. Certainly, the final texts of the Council had been voted, definitively approved, and solemnly promulgated by Pope Paul VI, in order to be translated and spread in the Catholic Church. But we should remember that in 1564, not long after the end of the Council of Trent, Pope Pius IV established a new congregation of the Roman Curia, the Congregation of the Council, that was its name. And that new congregation was in charge of interpreting the decrees of the Council of Trent and forbade the publication of any glosses or commentaries on them. From this point of view, the conclusion of Vatican II did not entail a prohibition on commenting on the final texts. Hence, the end of Vatican II did not imply that the Holy See and the Roman Curia held a strict monopoly on the interpretation of the Council texts, even if, as John O'Malley said a few years ago, and I quote, the Council was held in the center, named for the center, operated to a large extent with the equipment of the center, and was destined to be interpreted and implemented by the center, end quote. Thus, it comes as no surprise that the first opportunity for theologians to debate the Council's final documents was given by a series of commentaries on the texts. These commentaries being published for theologians, priests, seminarians, religious men and women, and also a broad readership eager to gain more familiarity with the texts of Vatican II. Of particular interest is that the most important of these commentaries came not from bishops who oversaw the drafting process, but from theologians acting during Vatican II as theological consultants, as periti, in the official commissions, or as private theologians serving their bishops during the preparations for their interventions in Aula and in the Council commissions. The main commentaries on the final documents of the Council represented an attempt to cast light on the deeper meaning of the text against the background of the history of the debate and to elaborate hypotheses on the Catholic Church's path after Vatican II. In the very first years after the Council, the ideological spectrum of Catholic theologians on Vatican II seemed to be much more unanimous than today in their enthusiastic acceptance of the final documents and their view of the novelty of Vatican II. For example, in ecclesiology, in liturgy, biblical revival, ecumenism, religious freedom, and interreligious relations. The tensions between the letter of the Council and the spirit of the Council did not play much of a role at that time, and neither did the supposed tension between the hermeneutics of continuity with the whole Catholic tradition and the awareness of discontinuity from Catholicism of the past, especially of the long 19th century between Pope Pius IX and Pope Pius XII. Nevertheless, behind the acceptance of Vatican II as a major turning point, even in the ranks of theologians of the so-called progressive majority, the nuances of how to read Vatican II could not conceal important differences. That kind of theological unanimity about Vatican II in the end of the 60s, early 70s, would not last. Towards the end of the Council, the debate concerning the content and the role of the pastoral constitution Gaudium et Spes revealed the division within 20th century theologians between the so-called Neo-Augustinians, among them Daniel Lou, de Lubac, Josef Ratzinger, and von Balthasar, and the so-called Neo-Thomists, Chenu, Congar, Karl Lanner, Lonergan, Skillebeck. The foundation of the journal Concilium in 1964 had represented the most notable attempt to spread the message of Vatican II by a group of scholars representing the vast majority of the reformers at Vatican II. But by 1970 already, the group had already had important defections, among them de Lubac, von Balthasar, and Ratzinger especially, signaling a rupture in the theologians' attitude toward Vatican II. A new international review, Communio, was founded in 1972 by Ratzinger, von Balthasar, and de Lubac as an attempt to offset the progressive Dutch-based journal Concilium and to scan the turmoil and confusion of battling ideologies and the clash of philosophies of life at the present day, as von Balthasar wrote for the editorial of the first issue of the new journal Communio. Writers for Communio preferred to interpret Vatican II with what they called a, quote, hermeneutics of continuity, emphasizing the solidarity of Vatican II with the whole Catholic tradition and the previous councils, and a more Augustinian approach to the issue of the relationship between the Church and the modern world. After a few years, we have 1968. The impact of 1968, a politically intense year around the world, the impact on the Catholic Church, and the effect of Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae on birth control had its toll on the reception of Vatican II and produced the first revisions of the Council's interpretations, inaugurating less enthusiastic and more wary views of the Council, but also a way of reading the Council that had to do with ideological standpoints than with the history of theology and church history. On one hand, the controversies of the early 70s for the Catholic Church did not bring together again the theologians of Vatican II, but contributed to an increasing rift between the interpretations of Vatican II. On the other hand, the former ultra-conservative minority at the Council proved more coherent in its fight against Vatican II. The small sect created by Monsignor Marcel Lefebvre in 1970, the Society of St. Pius X, represented quite effectively the awkward, to say the least, features of a contemporary Catholicism deliberately rejecting Vatican II and attached to a pre-modern theological culture and, to be very clear, to an anti-democratic and often anti-Semitic political worldview. The excommunication of Monsignor Lefebvre did not have significant effects on the debate about Vatican II, but at the beginning of 2009, Benedict XVI's lifting of the excommunications of the four bishops ordained by Lefebvre in 1988 cast a significant light on a veiled yet very active rift within European and especially North American Catholicism concerned the role of Vatican II. In 1978, John Paul II's election unleashed a new impulse for the reception of Vatican II by a bishop of Rome, a pope, who, 15 years before, as a bishop of Krakow in Poland, had been very active at Vatican II, especially in the commission for the drafting of the pastoral constitution Gaudium et Spes, and later as the author of a very bulky commentary on Vatican II in Polish. A third phase in the debate takes place between the 1980s and the 1990s, when the debate on Vatican II focused less on the contributions from theologians and began to become more influenced by the doctrinal policy of the Holy See, especially by Pope John Paul II and by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, appointed in 1981. Both first-rank participants at Vatican II, the first as a prominent young bishop from Poland, and the second a theological counselor of a prince of the German Church, Cardinal Frings of Cologne, they shaped a complex and sometimes contradictory Vatican policy toward the heritage of the Council and its role for contemporary Catholicism. After the theological interpretation of Vatican II that took place in the recodification of canon law, which led to the Code of 1983, John Paul II convened an extraordinary assembly of the Synod of Bishops in 1985 on the 20th anniversary of the conclusion of the Council to overcome polarization and bring about greater consensus. The Synod of 1985 and its final report provided the debate with some guidelines for the interpretation of the Council without questioning the riches of Vatican II, nor its key role for the future of the Catholic Church. We read in the Synod's final report that, and I quote, "The Council is a legitimate and valid expression and interpretation of the deposit of faith as it is found in sacred scripture and in the living tradition of the Church. Therefore, we are determined to progress further along the path indicated to us by the Council," end quote. The Synod was clear in recognizing, and I quote again, the deficiencies and difficulties in the acceptance of the Council. In truth, there certainly have also been shadows in the post-Council period, in part due to an incomplete understanding and application of the Council, in part to other causes. However, in no way can it be affirmed that everything which took place after the Council was caused by the Council." End quote. Concerning the issue of how to interpret Vatican II, the Synod of 1985 was resolute in explaining that, and I quote, "It is not licit to separate the pastoral character from the doctrinal vigor of the documents. In the same way, it is not legitimate to separate the spirit and the letter of the Council," end quote. The Synod pointed out the fact that the theological interpretation of the conciliar doctrine must show attention to all the documents in themselves and in their close interrelationship in such a way that the integral meaning of the Council's affirmations, often very complex, might be understood and expressed. As for the continuity-discontinuity issue, the final report did not take a position towards or against theological or historiographical schools, but reaffirmed the complex relationship between tradition and transition in Catholic theology, and I quote, "Moreover, the Council must be understood in continuity with the great tradition of the Church, and at the same time, we must receive light from the Council's own doctrine for today's Church and the man of our time. The Church is one and the same throughout all the councils." End quote. John Paul II's complex and sometimes contradictory orientation toward Vatican II, his decision to convene the Synod of 1985, and the overall result of the Synod for the state of the debate on Vatican II were somehow overshadowed by the famous Ratzinger Report that was timed to be published for the opening of the Synod and aimed at exerting pressure on the bishops and on public opinion in order to make a case for rethinking the approach to Vatican II and to point out the responsibility of Vatican II in the crisis of post-Vatican II Catholicism. At the same time, the doctrinal policy of the Holy See towards some key issues of Vatican II, such as ecclesiology, began unfolding from the mid-1980s on, both through the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and the International Theological Commission of the Holy See. The Congregation, published a new profession of faith in 1985, the letter to the bishops about the ecclesiology of communion, the famous letter Communionis Notio, published in May 1992, and the Declaration on the Unicity and Salvific Universality of Jesus Christ and the Church, was published in August 2000. They marked other important steps in the Roman reception of Vatican II. From the standpoint of the post-Vatican II governance of the Catholic Church, John Paul II's Apostolic Constitution Apostolos Suos of May 1998, on the status and authority of episcopal conferences, reinforced one of the basic assumptions of the International Theological Commission chaired by Cardinal Ratzinger, that is, the need to scale back some aspects of the post-Vatican II decentralization and empowerment of national bishop conferences. It seemed that power was being reclaimed by the Church's head in Rome at the expense of the Church's body throughout the world. A fourth moment was the era when Vatican II was finally studied historically. The most important wave of studies and research on Vatican II began in the late 1980s and early 1990s. In an international conference at the Centre Sèvres in Paris, in 1998, Giuseppe Alberigo, the leader of the Bologna School, started the enterprise that had its conclusion in 2001 with a five-volume history of the history of the Second Vatican Council that was published in seven languages. The history of Vatican II represented a major scholarly and historiographical exploration of the debate on Vatican II. On one side, the undertaking coordinated by Giuseppe Alberigo and the Bologna School called for a major effort in the search for undiscovered and unused archives of primary sources all over the world in gaining access to the official sources which the Holy See held in the archive of Vatican II. On the other side, the international and multidisciplinary character of the team of scholars working in this history provided the debate on Vatican II with many new questions, issues, and places for comparing perspectives, results, and paths of research. This major theological and historiographical work set the tone for the hermeneutical debate in these last 10 years. The last moment in this debate is today. Vatican II, dangerous or in danger? The 40th anniversary of the conclusion of the Council in 2005 did not have any significant impact on the theological debate surrounding Vatican II. But the death of John Paul II the last bishop participant at Vatican II to be elected Bishop of Rome, and the election of Benedict XVI constitutes, no doubt, two important elements in the broad theological and ecclesiastical landscape of the debate on Vatican II. The change of pontificate with Pope Benedict also nourished the journalistic and political dispute about Vatican II, its history, its legacy. Since April 2005, Benedict XVI's teachings have increasingly renewed both ecclesiastical and public scrutiny on the Council, bound up with the question about the legacy of the Vatican II era in the vitality of the contemporary Catholic Church and its impact on the Western world. After his famous address to the Roman Curia in December 2005, the Vatican document released in June 2007 on the ecclesiology and the famous passage of the subsistit in, which is in the Constitution on the Church at chapter 8, gave a feeling of a new age in the debate on the Council. Benedict XVI's teachings have refired a debate about the long taken for granted role of the Council in the Catholic Church, leaving the impression of a Roman policy review towards the Council. And I'm giving a few examples of this policy review. The motu proprio on the liturgy Summorum Pontificum of July 2007, which allowed for greater use of the Latin Tridentine Mass. In 2009, the lifting of the excommunications of the four bishops ordained by Lefebvre. They set a new tone, a new attitude in Rome about Vatican II, such as sometimes Vatican II seems to have been received much more deeply beyond the borders of Catholicism, especially the ad extra statements, the statements made for non-Catholics, especially in ecumenism, Jews, religious freedom, church, and modern world. Whereas within the Catholic Church, the debate on the interpretation of the core issues of Vatican II seems to be far from over. And now I'm giving you, and here starts the second section of this paper. It will take, not as much time as the first part, I'll promise you. I'll give you three examples of issues that are key in this debate on Vatican II. The first issue is the understanding of the Council as the beginning or the end of the renewal or reform of the Church. The second issue is the view of the dynamics of the Council texts. And the third issue is the issue of change and historicity in the Church and in theology. The first issue is Vatican II the beginning or the end of some changes in the Catholic Church? One of the major fault lines in the interpretation of the Council lies between the view of the Council as the end and conclusion of a process of renewal, or as the beginning of a renewal based on the perception of the Council as more than the collection of its final document. This fault line mirrors the distinction between the emphasis on the letter of the Council documents on one side and the interpretation of the letter of the Council in its spirit, following, and spirit means following the intention of the actors of the event and its recipients. Nevertheless, this version, Vatican II as the end or the beginning, reveals the practical and ecclesial implications of these hermeneutics, as well as the stark difference between the two interpretations. The advocates of Vatican II as the beginning of the renewal can easily demonstrate their augmentative view of the Council reflects what always happened in the history of post-Council periods of every Council, and finds a basis In some of the major decisions of politics, for example, the official approval of many new Catholic movements that have no place in the teachings of the Council, for example, and of John Paul II, who expanded the letter of the Concilia Declaration Nostra Aetate through his very personal magisterium of his acts, such as the interreligious gathering in Assisi in 1986, or his visit in the Great Mosque of Damascus in 2001. In other words, the perception of Vatican II as a beginning is not new, but that goes back to a famous lecture given by Karl Rahner in 1965 during the last few weeks of the Council, a lecture entitled The Council, Beginning of a Beginning. In that famous lecture, Rahner developed this insight in the framework of his vision of the history of Christianity, not according to the chronology of the papacy or the relationship church and state, or even according to the history of the Council, but according to macro periods in the history of Christianity. This way, for Rahner, Vatican II was becoming a beacon for the future of the Church, but also a transitional moment. So Rahner saw in the history of the Church that with Vatican II, a big macro period was ending, and the new macro period was beginning. In a way, he said, Vatican II plays the same role that played the famous Council of Jerusalem, of which we read in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 15, when Christianity became a small religion, starting from being a small Jewish sect. So he said, Vatican II must be understood in the light of the meaning of ushering an entirely new era, such just as it happened for the very first councils in the history of Christianity. I think this view is very much accurate, spot on what Vatican II was, because viewing Vatican II as a moment of beginning places Vatican II fully in the history of ecumenical councils, just like Trent was only the beginning of the Tridentine era, but at the same time puts Vatican II under the scope of its uniqueness. Accepting the idea of Vatican II as the beginning often implies accepting Vatican II as an event of the Spirit, whose impulse did not abandon the Church after the end of Vatican II. Conversely, seeing in Vatican II the end of the renewal assumes a different pneumatological vision of the Council, and clearly a negative assessment not only of what happened after Vatican II, but also of much of what happened at Vatican II. In this sense, the present clash of narratives about Vatican II cannot be solved only through the study of the history of the Council of its document, but also through a genuine discern of the elements of what Ormond Rush called a reception pneumatology, where we have three instances. We have the sensus fidelium, the faith of the average Catholic, the work of theologians, and the oversight of the Church's magisterium in that order. Accepting the idea of the reception of the Council means accepting Vatican II as the beginning of the process of reception. Playing down the theological dignity of the reception equals identifying the letter of the documents of Vatican II with the conclusion of the process, that is, with its final documents, and vice versa. In my judgment, refusing to see in Vatican II the beginning of the renewal is an assertion not only unfaithful to the intention of Vatican II, it also shows scant confidence in the ability of the Church to manage change on the basis of a Spirit-assisted understanding of the signs of the times. The second key hermeneutical issue in the debate on Vatican II is how should we read the documents of the Council, these 16 documents. Where do we start? Most historians and theologians of the Council have reached a consensus affirming that Vatican II is both a corpus of documents and an event, and that Vatican II should be known and understood in its letter and in its spirit. But the recent emphasis that polemics have given to the relationship between letter and spirit of the Council implies that the need for research on Vatican II to take a step forward from the history of Vatican II to the history of post-Vatican II theology, that is, of the reception of the Council in post-conciliar theology. Now, what we have seen in these last few years, it's a very interesting phenomenon, which is in the very first years after the Council, we had a very strong emphasis among theologians and bishops on the ecclesiology, what Vatican II teaches about the Church. In these last few years, we have seen the debate shifting, moving in a different direction, which, in my view, is healthy, is a positive phenomenon. I mean, towards another document, which is Dei Verbum, the Constitution on the Revelation and on Scripture. That is a new development, and for this we owe a great deal of thinking to a German-French Jesuit. His name is Christoph Theobald, who has published the first volume of a two-volume work on Vatican II, and the first volume is 1,000 pages. So the second will be published in 2014, and it will be another 1,000 pages. So we have some time to digest. And he says a very interesting thing. He said, if we look at the documents of the Council, we see an architecture that is built in two axes. We have an horizontal axis that has two directions, an ad intra dimensions, so what Vatican II says to the Church about the Church, and we have another direction, ad extra, what Vatican II says to the Church and to the world. And this axis, this horizontal dimension, is balanced with a vertical dimension in the teachings of the Council that gives priority to the idea of the revelation that is expressed in the Constitution Dei Verbum of the Council and in the Declaration on Religious Liberty, Dignitatis Humanae. So, and for Theobald, we have that the Church is just the conjunction of these two axes. And that is a very brilliant way to make sense of 40 years of ecclesiological debates, and at the same time to shift from that church-centered debate to the revelation, which I think it's a healthy development. The third issue is the issue of change and historicity in the Church and in theology. So the basic question is, how much change can the Church handle? How much change? How slow? How quick? The very first years of the beginning of the post-Council or post-Vatican II Church were marked by the crisis of papal authority on the basis of the teaching on birth control contained in Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae of 1968. Not just a concern for moral theologians or Catholic married couples, This crisis explained one of the crucial issues of Vatican II, that is, how to manage change and continuity in the Catholic Church. In a way, the history of the debate about Humanae Vitae explains why that landmark papal teaching of 1968 inaugurated the disillusionment of the post-Vatican II era and symbolized the beginning of a fracture between the magisterium, the bishops and Rome on one side, and a theology that had left metaphysics as its center of orientation and had become increasingly a theology of salvation history, where human history also becomes a real source for theological work. The relevance granted by theologians to the role of history and change in theology is by far the most important factor in the parting ways of Catholic theology after Vatican II and about Vatican II. On one side, there are those who see in the hermeneutics of continuity the only possible hermeneutical option regarding Vatican II. That is, they stress the need to interpret Vatican II in absolute continuity with the previous tradition, especially Trent and Vatican I, not before. On the other side, there are those who see in Catholicism a period before Vatican II and a very different period after Vatican II, and that there is a clear discontinuity and change between these two periods, Vatican II representing the turning point for this change, which is, in their view, clearly for the better. In the contemporary debate about the Council, it has become clear that the issue of change is not mainly related to the hermeneutical relationship between Vatican I and Vatican II, but to the relationship between the Council of Trent, 1545-1563, and Vatican II. In this respect, it is remarkable to see how particular this chronological interpretation of continuity is, as it attempts to establish a steady but clearly selective pick and choose, a selective continuity in the last five centuries of the history of the Church. This continuous interpretation does not accept the idea of an historical discontinuity in the history of the first millennium between the beginning of the Constantine era of the Imperial Church and in the second millennium between the Council of Trent and the Tridentine era until the 19th century. This interpretation of the relationship between the historical nature of the Church and theology on one side and the issue of continuity, discontinuity on the other side often forgets a basic fact about the obvious amount of discontinuity in the history of the Church and of the Councils. To give an example dear to the ultra-traditionalist mindset, it is quite known that the Council of Trent meant a clear change from the lack of theological clarity that was typical of the theological tradition before Trent. So we had a change inaugurated by Trent. It is also known that the fortunes of the Council of Trent in creating what we now call the Tridentine era are also the result of the discontinuities between the letter of the decrees of Trent and their application, that is, the spirit of the Tridentine Church. In light of Church history, and Church historians like me are a dying breed now, it becomes clear that the supposed opposition between the letter of the text of an ecumenical council and its spirit cannot be solved easily with a simple contraposition of the two hermeneutical moments in favor of the pure spirit, not by affirming the an ancillary supplemental role of the spirit. It is true that in the post-Vatican II period, Catholic theology has sometimes indulged in a para-council and forgotten the real council, but that is certainly true on both sides of the aisle. On one side, the impatient exaltation of discontinuity and renewal was matched, on the other side, by the self-deluding illusion of the possibility of a perfect linearity between pre-Vatican II theology, the text of the preparation of the Council 1959-1961, and the final text. It is time to re-acknowledge that the character of Vatican II as an event of church history is a fundamental aspect of the history of this council, as it was for every council. But the hermeneutical framework has changed. So we read text in a different way because we are modern human beings. And for Vatican II, the feature of event has been more dramatic and the change more visible thanks to the global dimension of Vatican II, the first council of post-European Catholicism. Now, the last couple of minutes, my take on this debate, if it's not clear enough from what I just said. In the 1980s especially, interpreters of the Council applied to Vatican II the idea of a paradigm shift, the definition given during the years of the Council by the famous historian of science Thomas Kuhn in his famous book of 1962, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. But to understand the comparison between the history of science and the history of theology, one of the most important laws has been used much less. That is, in the history of science and of human knowledge, usually, a major scientific advance is almost always overestimated in the short run and almost always underestimated in the long run. This is what is happening to Vatican II in my judgment. 50 years after the event of the Council, we find ourselves in that crucial moment of passage between the short run and the long run. The clash of narratives about Vatican II encounters here the perennial law of the reception of the councils of the Church. The current underestimation of Vatican II in many circles is no different from the underestimation of the consequences of the discovery, I'll give you one example, of the vaccines against smallpox and polio. What is disturbing, especially in the last few years, is that the younger generation of Catholics have been credited by theological pundits with a detached or even skeptical view of the Council, as if the Council is something they feel to need to take distance from, as if the common ground they seek could only be as distant as possible from Vatican II. My experience as a teacher, teaching Vatican II, could not be more different from this misperception. Whether liberal or conservative, Catholics and Catholic students of every theological and spiritual orientation know well that longing for and aspiring to revive the period before Vatican II is a dream nourished only by people who do not live the real day-to-day reality of the Church. Ecumenism, religious freedom, the rejection of anti-Semitism cannot be reduced to partisan issues. The post-9/11 world has revealed the prophetic value of documents like Nostra Aetate. To belittle Vatican II is to belittle these achievements as well. While disparaging those achievements means disparaging the very theology of Vatican II that brought about this opening of the Church ad extra, but also the reflection of the Church ad intra. The complexity of the debate on the Council has also to do with the fact that the history of the post-Vatican II Church intertwines with the growth in knowledge and awareness of Catholic theology about Vatican II. In other words, the Catholic Church now knows a significant amount of information about Vatican II. The amount of information about the change that happened at Vatican II is probably more than Catholic theology expected, and quite surely more than the Church as an institution was ready to handle. But the communion of the Church is much better equipped to handle the rediscovery of its past than the intellectuals on the payroll of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, who, when faced with the permanent ideological manipulation of recent history, were mocked with this popular Soviet era joke, and I quote, "We know exactly what the future will be. Our problem is with the past that keeps changing." Now, the past has not been changed by the lively historical and theological debate about Vatican II. And that is a comforting sign of the vitality of the Church in a world where the so-called neo-atheism takes pride in seeing faith and debate as opposite terms. The historicization of Vatican II, starting in the late 1980s, has clearly introduced a hermeneutical shift, a new way of interpreting Vatican II. Therefore, it is not surprising that the abundance of information about Vatican II has not solved the issue of the need for a coherent and shared interpretation of the Council documents yet. We may have the impression sometimes that knowing more about Vatican II has complicated the issue of its interpretation. But choosing to know less about Vatican II is not a viable option. It's not even possible anymore. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we can close this evening. I'd like to thank Professor Fagioli. I have little to add, but I'd like to stress the position of Paul VI that unless we look at the Council as an event, and not as a static event, as a written document once and for all, but as a dynamic event, almost a quasi-sacramental event, in which all the bishops, cum et superto, has taken place and put their names on the documents, will be stuck in things which we will never resolve. And the spirit of Vatican II, I mean, by Lord, to quote a philosopher who is not very popular in the Catholic Church, but I quote Karl Marx's critique in his thesis, his 11 theses against Feuerbach. In the 11 theses, he says, philosophers have tried to interpret the world. The problem is to change it. I think our duty is to change the world. And as Paul VI said on the feast of Our Lady, or the Immaculate Conception of Our Lady, I repeat again what I said earlier. We should consider the Council in virtù di principio piuttosto che compito di conclusione. Thank you very much.
Hamsin sena wara. Ħarsa lejn il-Konċilju Ekumeniku Vatikan it-tieni mal-istoriku Awċi Monsinjur Joe Bezzina.
Is-siklu 20 kellu papiet kbar ħafna. Papiet illi kieku ma kenux imħabtin baffariet oħrajn, kienu kapaċi jagħmlu konċilju u mexxu imexxuħu l-qudiem u ġibu fil-Knisja l-bidla li kien hemm neċessarja. Iżda il-papiet tas-siklu 20 kellhom ħabtu wiċċhom ma' żewġ gwerer kbar. L-ewwel gwerra dinjija mill-1914 u l-1918 u t-tieni gwerra dinjija bejn l-1939 u l-1945. U anke meta ma kienx hemm gwerra, kien hemm dik li jdur għall-gwerra bierda. Fil-pajjiżi għalkemm ma kienx qegħdin jiġġieldu b'mod formali imma kienu beqgħu kontra xulxin. U għal daqstant il-Papa hawnhekk ħansemmu l-Papa ta' qabel il-Konċilju Vatikan it-tieni, il-Papa Piju 12, kien Papa li tħadem u tħabat ħafna u ħadem ħafna biex iġib il-paċi fid-dinja. Kien Papa elett propju kif bdiet il-gwerra t-tieni gwerra dinjija u kważi l-enerġija kollha tiegħu ħlija. Mhux ħlija, imma ġifier ma setax jagħmel affarijiet oħrajn. L-enerġija kollha tiegħu wried propju juża' għal din il-paċi. U biex tinżamm din il-paċi fost il-kriżijiet kbar illi kienu jinqelgħu anke imbagħad wara t-tieni gwerra dinjija. Kriżijiet illi bdew jinqelgħu kienu iktar profondi minħabba li l-bniedem kien kixef il-qawwa nukleari u nħoloq il-bomba nukleari. Li kienet kapaċi taqret l-istess dinja u l-medmin kollha tagħha. U għal daqstant kien meħtieġ illi issa ikun hemm xi papa illi minkejja kollox jgħid isma' jiena hemm bżonn u rrid illi nsejjaħ konċilju. U dan kellu jkun il-Papa Ġwanni 23. Fil-qosor nsemmu dan il-Papa Ġwanni 23 kien papa illi twielet familja l-iktar normali, familja kważi biex ngħidu hekk, tabdiewa f'post jismu sotto l-monte, naħata fuq tal-Italja, fil-provinċja ta' Bergamo, fil-25 ta' Novembru 1888. Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli, għax hekk kien jismu, irċieva edukazzjoni tradizzjonali, familja b'ħafna tfal, familja f'ira, imma familja li kienet reliġjuża ħafna. U għal daqstant kien papa qrib ħafna tan-nies. Huwa ħadem f'ħafna setturi fil-ħajja tiegħu. Kien jgħallem l-istorja tal-Knisja, kien anke nunzju apostoliku tal-Papa fit-Turkija. U kien jaf in-nies x'iridu, kien jaf li n-nies iridu t-tiġdid, kien jaf meta kien fit-Turkija illi kien hemm anke x-xewqa ta' ċertu waqda bejn iż-żewġ knejjes infakru illi l-Knisja fit-Turkija Knisja kompletament ortodossa. U għal daqshekk dan kien papa illi seta' jifhem aħjar is-sitwazzjonijiet ta' żmienu. U għal daqstant meta ġie elettu fit-28 Ottubru tal-1958, fuq tron ta' Pietru kien hemm papa illi kellu esperjenza kbira. Imma kien papa xieħ, kellu ma' 79 sena. U għal daqstant kulħadd ħaseb għal dana ikun pontifikat kwiet. Pontifikat bejn papa kbir kien il-papa Piju 12 sakemm isir papa ieħor. Però dan il-papa mill-ewwel diskors tiegħu qal li qed jagħmel ħafna enfasi illi jkun ir-rajiet tajjeb. Ir-rajiet tajjeb kif imsemmi fil-Vanġelu ta' San Ġwan, fl-10 kapitlu ta' Vanġelu San Ġwan illi jkun raj illi jifhem il-merħla tiegħu, raj illi fl-istess ħin jipprova jġib il-qudiem il-merħla tiegħu. U peress li l-Papa kien ħadem fid-diplomazija u għalhekk kellu żgur ħafna u ħafna prattika fil-ħtieġa tad-diskussjonijiet, kien il-Papa illi nistgħu ngħidu ntażi verament mill-Ispirtu Santu f'dal każ biex fl-aħħar fil-Knisja jinħoloq kunċilju li jġib bidla sieħa. Il-Konċilju Vatikan it-tieni.
Fiduciosa la povera gente, al buon Papa chiedeva la grazia, e dal cielo il servo di Dio non mancava da correre ancora. Tanti sono già i miracolati che il buon Papa giammai abbandona. Viva il Papa di sotto il monte, viva il Figlio celeste del cielo. Viva, viva il Papa Giovanni, il Santo Papa buono, glorioso Papa d'amore.
Dick Kenneth Produzioni, Miss Segretariata all'Aici Ferdan, l'Arcidiocesi di Kamalta.
Campus FM.
Hamsin Sena Wara. Harsa lein il Concilio Ecumenico Vaticanettini, ma l'istorico auci Monsignor Joe Bezzina.
Il Papi Giovanni Tlita Oċrin, mela kien elett kif jedna fit-28 Ottubru tal-1958. Inqas minn 90 ġurnata wara, nhar it-25 ta' Jannar 1959, wara l-intenzjoni tiegħu li jagħmel konċilju. Dina il-Papa kien żamma kważi sigrieta għal kollox. U fil-fatt il-tħabbira tal-Konċilju Vatikan it-tieni saret b'mod l-iktar informali. Il-Papa kien għadu kif spiċċa iċ-ċeremonja ta' talpa l-unità fil-Knisja fil-Bażilika ta' San Paolo fuq l-Emmure. U kien mistieden mill-abbati tal-Bażilika ja Bażilika Mexxija mill-Monaxi għal kafè. U kien hemm anke l-kardinali l-oħra li kienu mistieden li ħaddu sehem din iċ-ċeremonja. U propju fis-sala, fis-salott ta' dana il-kunvent, waqt li kien qed jieħu il-kafè, il-Papa waqqafhom u qalilhom qiegħed nitrijed m'hemm li emozzjoni. Imma b'umiltà kbira ngħidilkom illi jiena ddeċidejt illi nipproklama u li nagħmel żewġ affarijiet. Sinodu Diċesan ġewwa Ruma u Konċilju Ġenerali fil-Knisja Universali. Dawn il-kelmiet quddiem il-kardinali kien issa splodiet bomba għax ħadd ma kien jistenna illi dan il-Papa illi kulħadd ħasbu Papa transitorju ben pontifikat wara pontifikat kbir u pontifikat ieħor li kellu għad jiġri illi seta qatt jagħmel dana il-pass. Il-qudiem kif kiteb fil-autobiografija tiegħu Journal of a Soul jgħid illi huwa kien imnebbaħ mill-Ispirtu Santu biex propju jkun jista' jagħmel dan il-Konċilju. U jider illi il-Papa kien konvint. Dakinhar meta ħabar il-Konċilju qalilhom il-waħda mill-affarijiet li jixtieq jagħmel kienet riforma fil-kodiċi tad-dritt kanoniku. Imma wkoll qalilhom illi jeħtieġ illi l-Knisja iktar u iktar tagħti u tagħmel enfasi fuq l-attività apostolika. Fit-tliet xhur li dan Papa rakam kien meħtieġa li jġib quddiem il-fidi ir-reliġjon tal-irwieħ tan-nies. Ra kemm kien meħtieġa illi l-Knisja tkun iktar taħseb, tkun iktar irranġata l-liturġija tagħha, l-istrutturi tagħha għan-nies li kienu bdej jgħixu fis-seklu wara nofs wara t-tieni nofs tas-seklu 20. U għalhekk il-Papa ra li l-unika mod kif se jagħmel dan u li jsejjaħ Konċil Ġenerali li jisma għalhekk x'iridu l-isfqijiet minn madwar id-dinja kollha u li jsejjaħ dan il-Konċilju. Il-Konċilju illi kien ħaj sejja kiet xi ħaġa kbira ħafna. Il-għaliex il-Papa Pju 12, il-Papa ta' qablu, kien Papa li kellu ċertu awra ta' supernaturalità. Fatti jingħad li anke darba derlu Kristu. U kien Papa li però qatt ma ħass illi jagħmel dan il-pass. U għal daqstant kif jiġi Papa illi kien Papa twajjeb, Papa li ġej minn familja ta' bdiewa, Papa illi karattru hekk affabbli, illi b'awtorità kbira jgħid irid nagħmel il-Konċilju. U r-riżoluzzjoni tiegħu biex jagħmel dan il-Konċilju, jiġifieri ma kienx lest li jċiedi quddiem ebda ostaklu kienet kbira ħafna. Fil-fatt, mill-mument tal-25 ta' Jannar tal-1959 għallhom ċar Rutont illi huwa kien konvint illi dal-Konċilju iseħ u seħ mill-aktar fil spissu.
Kienet produzzjoni mis-Segretarjat tal-Laiċi fiħdan l-Arċidjoċesi ta' Malta.